Criminology is a true crime podcast that may contain discussion about violent or disturbing topics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to episode 81 of Criminology. I'm Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morford.
Mr. Morford, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm busy doing 25 hours worth of work in a 24-hour day. But besides that, I'm feeling good. How about you?
Yeah, I tell you, aren't we all? I've said this before, but I think we work too hard. And I don't, when I say we, I don't mean you and I mean, just everybody. Everybody works too hard. Everything is too go, go, go. We don't relax enough anymore.
Yeah, and I know you've got multiple podcasts. I've got multiple podcasts. And I just feel that if I'm sitting around not doing something, I feel like I'm wasting time. So I got to keep busy.
All right, Murph, we had some new Patreon supporters. So let's give some shout outs. We had Pam Fitz, Marlene Lewis, Twisty McWiz Popper, Rosalind Hesby, Vanessa DeHaro, and Billy Seppinen. So big thanks to all those people that chose to support the show. We love it.
We say it all the time, but it's really true. We definitely appreciate all that Patreon support. And if you'd like to help support Criminology on Patreon, you can too by going to patreon.com/criminology.
All right, Morph, let's jump right into this episode. We are discussing one of the most high-profile missing person cases in the northeast part of the United States. It's the disappearance of 17-year-old Brianna Maitland. She vanished without a trace from a small town in Vermont on March 19th, 2004. She disappeared just a little bit over a month after Maura Murray disappeared from Massachusetts, and that has led some to speculate that the two New England area cases might be related. 15 years later, Brianna's case, much like Maura Murray's, still intrigues amateur sleuths and true crime fans alike. But what really happened to Brianna Maitland? That question remains unanswered. Brianna's father, Bruce Maitland, joined us for this episode to help sort through the details in Brianna's case, and you'll hear from him throughout the episode.
Brianna Alexandria Maitland was born on October 8, 1986, to Bruce and Kelly Maitland. She has an older brother named Waylon. Brianna and Waylon were raised on a farm outside East Franklin, Vermont, about 300 feet from the Canadian border. Growing up, Brianna trained several years in jiu-jitsu. She was raised in a household with no television, so Brianna turned to books to entertain herself. Her mom once called her a voracious reader, because she had read every novel by authors such as Anne Rice, Margaret Atwood, and Maya Angelou, as well as the writings of Greek poet Homer. Brianna enjoyed literary works that held meaningful life lessons. She also loved the outdoors, especially spending time four-wheeling or snowmobiling through the countryside, and swimming and hanging out at Lake Carmi Beach with her friends. She also loved music and dancing.
Brianna was just an absolute joy to be around. A lot of fun. She could light up a room when she walked in, just personable, fun-loving. She had another side where she was quite a reader. She spent a lot of time reading books, and it was just great to be around her. As a kid, she was always excited about a lot of different things, and it was just kind of great to watch her grow. And then as she kind of got into her teen, and she was very mature for her age, always kind of, I would say maybe from the time she was 10 or 12, she started to act a little bit more like a grown-up. In a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways, she was still a kid, and it's just kind of that mix. But she was very outgoing and very accepting of everybody, meeting new people, in the extent that she was accepting of everybody, I don't think she had a good good discernment, you know, between good and bad people. She just seen some bit of good in about everybody. And that was one of those things I didn't get too concerned about it, but I sure thought a lot about, you know, after she went missing.
By 2003, Brianna evolved into a beautiful, creative, and fiercely independent young woman. She attended Mrs. Coy Valley Union High School and was described by many as outgoing, smart, and just really a fun person to be around. Brianna had a mind of her own, and once she set her mind to something, there was no talking her out of it. But Brianna had grown restless and somewhat bored living in the rural area where she was raised. In late 2003, Brianna moved in with her friend Kate Manning and started attending a new high school, Innisburg Falls High School.
Brianna had moved out of the house. Brianna was, is a person who was, you know, was kind of 17 going on 25. And there had been some disagreements, but we had lived kind of a back to the lander, is the best way I could describe it, lifestyle at the time. You know, we had a house in the woods, a mile from the nearest neighbor in the woods, and we made our own electricity and just kind of lived a subsistence life. So she was a bit more isolated, certainly there, than what she wanted to be. And at the time, she was living with a girlfriend of hers at the time at her girlfriend's parents' place. And I didn't like the fact that she had chosen that. So, you know, I was like, well, Brianna, you want to act like a grown-up, then you got to support yourself and stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to, you know, promote this, or enable it would be a better word. And not going to enable this by, you know, giving her money and things like that.
As 2004 began, Brianna's closest friends from her previous school noticed a change in her. She started partying a lot. She began hanging out with a crowd that, frankly, they didn't like seeing her with. One of the girls in that crowd was Keely LaCrosse, whom Brianna had befriended at Innisburg Falls High School. The two met when Brianna introduced herself to Keely in gym class, and the pair became close friends after that.
For whatever reason, Brianna had to move out of Katie Manning's house and ended up staying with multiple friends. And at one point, she was even living out of her car in freezing temperatures. By February 2004, she wasn't hanging out with Keely and their group of friends as much and became isolated. This affected her performance at school, and Brianna ultimately dropped out of high school. Brianna then moved in with childhood friend Jillian Stout and her family in Sheldon, Vermont, and she enrolled in a GED program at a community college. By this time, Brianna's and Keely's friendship was over. Keely spoke in a phone interview with Chloe Canner, who hosts the podcast True Crime Twins, and is also part of the Crawl Space podcast team, alongside her pals Tim and Lance.
In her interview with Chloe Canner, Keely talked about why her friendship with Brianna dissolved. She said that at the time, she had a boyfriend named James Robitaille. The two had been together for the past couple years. When Keely went out of state for a week to visit her mother, she said Brianna went behind her back and stayed with her boyfriend James. Keely found out about this incident from some friends when she returned home, and she confronted James. He admitted that Brianna stayed at his house. Keely and Brianna stopped hanging out after that. Keely also said that a few weeks later, she saw Brianna sitting in the passenger seat of James' car. Keely was furious. She said she started screaming. She started calling Brianna names, but Brianna never responded.
On February 27, 2004, there was a party at the Pallet Factory in Innisburg. James showed up with Brianna. Keely was already at the party, and when she saw the two together, she was livid. She intimidated Brianna the entire night, trying to get a rise out of her, but Brianna didn't bite. Later on in the evening, Keely noticed Brianna wasn't at the party, but James was still there. He told her that Brianna was sitting out in his truck, so Keely went out to the truck and confronted Brianna, antagonizing her and trying to get her to come out of the truck to fight. At some point, Keeley punched Brianna twice, giving her two black eyes and a concussion. Despite being trained in the martial arts, Brianna never fought back, and Keeley stopped fighting, telling Brianna, "You're not worth it."
The following day, Brianna's mother, Kelly, took her to the hospital. Brianna decided to press charges against Keeley LaCrosse, and police started an investigation. It was around this same time that Brianna landed two part-time jobs, one as a dishwasher at the Black Lantern Inn in nearby Montgomery, and one as a waitress at KJ's Diner in St. Albans. She was set to start work at the diner on the morning of March 20th, 2004. On the day of March 19th, Brianna took her GED test in the morning. Then she went out for breakfast and clothes shopping with her mother in St. Albans. Brianna needed a pair of black pants for the diner job. So the two of them were in the checkout lane at a store when Brianna told her mom that she would be right back. Her mom paid for the pants and then saw Brianna outside at her car waiting for her. It's been reported that during this quick shopping trip, Brianna's demeanor had changed. She seemed nervous. She seemed as though she wanted to get home very quickly. Kelly didn't press Brianna for details about what was troubling her. There are some people that allege that someone in the store warned Brianna that something bad was going to happen to her. But Brianna's father, Bruce, disputes that her demeanor suddenly changed while at the store at all.
I guess the biggest one, because it seemed to have hit the news quite a bit, is, you know, there was situations where maybe Brianna ran into the person or ran into somebody that was trying to warn her the day before when she was with her mother. And that pops up on the internet. And I really put no stock in that. That's what I consider to be a false head.
Brianna was scheduled to work the night shift at the Black Lantern Inn later that night, and she got ready for work when she returned home from shopping with her mom. On her way out, she left a note for Jillian that read, "I get off work between 10 and 12. I'll see you after." Brianna's night at work was a busy one. Her shift ended at 11:20 p.m. Brianna's coworkers asked her to have dinner with them, but she declined, saying she was tired and had to get up early for her second job. The employees saw her get into her light green 1983 Oldsmobile 88 sedan and drive off. Brianna Maitland was never seen again.
Between 11:30 p.m. and 12:30 a.m., a man was driving on Route 118 when he saw a car backed into an abandoned house that was known to the locals as the Dutch Burn House. He thought the headlights may have been on, but he didn't give the sighting a second thought. Between 12 a.m. and 12:30 a.m., another man saw the car and said a signal light was flashing. Then, around 4 a.m., Brianna's ex-boyfriend drove by that location on his way home from a party. He thought he recognized the car, and he stopped to check it out. When he stopped, he immediately knew that the car was Brianna's, but there was no sign of her.
And this is where people go down a rabbit hole, and I try to shut this rabbit hole down, okay? But, I mean, she had an ex-boyfriend who she was not involved with at any point. And I guess I want to say out front, he's not a suspect. Multiple interviews, you know, my private investigators have talked to him a number of times. The state police have done a number of times. They claim to have broken him down really good. But he happened to be coming home from another place. And people will say, "Oh my gosh, that's too much coincidence." But the truth is that little road is if you're coming in from the west, it's a very mountainous region. That's the only road in and out of that area. And he happened to have lived in that area. So before people in the true crime group immediately jump to, "Oh, it's an ex-boyfriend," in this case, it's not. But anyhow, he found the car and he recognized the car. That's Brianna's car, got out, and he said, well, he, you know, walked over to see if she was in the car, if she was all right, and he shut the doors and shut the headlights off. Now, it was a, you know, cold night, rain, snow mix, that sort of thing. I'm not quite sure of his processes of why he actually did that, but I believe it was at that point, he knows nothing either.
Later that morning, tourists were driving on Route 118 and spotted the pale green Oldsmobile packed up against the Dutch burn house, and they thought the scene didn't look right. They parked their car, got out, and took photographs of the car. They are the only photographs of the car that can be seen by the public. And if listeners out there haven't seen photos of Brianna's car, it's a very odd-looking photo that you can find by Googling Brianna's name. As they walked around the car, they noticed a water bottle, a broken necklace, which was later confirmed to be Brianna Maitland's, and some loose change on the ground next to the driver's side. Brianna's car keys were missing. Bruce Maitland described the tourists finding the car.
Saturday morning, some guys came by that skied together, and they were on the way to the ski lodge, and they looked there, and they said, "Oh my gosh, look at that weird how that car is into that building. It's so strange." So they took some pictures, and then they went on their way.
At 1:22 p.m., a Vermont state trooper was dispatched to the Dutch burn house after a call came in regarding an abandoned vehicle at that location. When he arrived at the house, he observed the car partially parked inside the house. This was almost as if someone had put the car in reverse and rammed it into the house. Police later said the scene looked staged. The trooper figured out who the driver was when he found two paychecks made out to Brianna Maitland. He wrote down the license plate number and then had the car towed to a local automotive shop. The car's owner was listed as Kelly Maitland, but instead of calling her, the trooper drove to the Black Lantern Inn. So he took this information from one of the paychecks. The Black Lantern Inn was closed and was not set to open until later that day. But the trooper had other work to do that kept him from following up on the car. The trooper assumed that Kelly would eventually call police, wondering what happened to her car. Bruce described in detail for us how police came upon the car, and he also detailed the damage at the scene.
A little later, the state trooper came by when he was on patrol, and he found the car. To this day, I don't really know his thought processes. I guess he assumed it was a drunk driver, but it was just like drunk drivers don't back their car, 50, 60 feet off the road into buildings. But he just called it in to a local garage who does the towing and had the car towed. And then he finished his shift for the day and went home. And everything that he found and was in the file was just left. So when the police found the car, it was the car was just bashed into the building as you see it in the picture. Doors closed, lights out. There wasn't too much damage to the car. There was some trunk damage to the car. I remember there was a big crease in the trunk. The car jumped, the rear bumper of the car cleared the foundation of the house and kind of bashed into the side of the house, into the wood part then at that point. And so the car was actually stuck in the house, maybe 6 inches, maybe a foot.
Bruce Maitland thinks that had the trooper that initially found Brianna's car been more proactive, the official search for her could have started sooner.
Later on, years later, when I developed some good relations with some of the police, and that was one of the things that they changed procedurally for them, that no one goes home, no troopers go home without filing the reports of what's going on, because the car was registered to Brianna's mother at the time. If we would have received a phone call, that next morning, we would have been 2 days ahead of where we were.
The Dutch burn farmhouse where Brianna's car was found had been abandoned for years, but it had once been the scene of an attack that was big news around town. Back in the 1980s, two elderly brothers named Harry Dutch Burn and Mike Dutch Burn were attacked in their home. They had lived there since June 1915 when their family first moved in. At around 2 a.m. on January 31st, 1986, two men knocked on their door saying they were out of gas. The knocking woke the men up, and Mike shouted back that they did not have any gas. but the knocking persisted. Mike got out of bed and walked downstairs. He hadn't even got to the door yet when one of the men barged into their house.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Bravo Bros.
Good job.
Mike yelled at the man, you shouldn't be here. The man hit Mike in the face. He later said the man was wearing brass knuckles or something to that effect on his hand. Mike fought back until he saw another man and said later that he knew he couldn't fight both of these men at his age. Maybe when he was younger, he could have taken them on, but not at this time. Soon after this, Harry came downstairs. One of the men knocked him unconscious with a cane he used to prod his cattle. Both men then turned on Mike and continued to beat him. Harry and Mike were known to keep large sums of money, and it turned out that the men were there to rob them. Harry had approximately $6,000 in his shirt pocket at the time of the robbery, and the men took that along with some other cash they found. This brutal attack lasted only about 5 minutes, and then the men took off. Mike laid on the kitchen floor for 3.5 hours, too afraid to move. His brother Harry was still unconscious. Harry and Mike didn't have a telephone at the time of the attack. When Mike saw his neighbor's house light go on at dawn, he crawled out to his Chevy pickup truck and drove the half mile to his neighbor's house to call police.
What the robbers didn't count on was that all of the money they stole from the Dutchburn brothers had a very distinctive smell to it. Harry and Mike spent hours every day farming and in their barn, so evidently their money picked up smells that you might find at a farm. Police alerted all Vermont banks and businesses to be on the lookout for $100 bills with a strong odor. The salesman at Champlain Chevrolet in Enosburg knew that odor well, because Mike Dutchburn had purchased a truck there, and the scent lingered in the air long after he was gone. So when two men walked in one day and paid for a car with $100 bills that had a strong odor, the salesman called police.
So, Morph, when you think about what transpired, this must have been a hell of an odor for it to attach itself to this money, for a salesman to remember that he had smelled it before, and to immediately smell it when these two men tried to buy this car. This money eventually led police to two men. Vermont State Police arrested 37-year-old Daryl Clark and 30-year-old Louis Gilbo and charged them with aggravated assault, robbery, and attempted assault and robbery. Daryl Clark already had a criminal record of larceny and assault. In 1987, a judge sentenced him to 5 to 10 years in jail and sentenced Gilbo to 8 to 10. With all but five suspended for the Dutch Burn home invasion and assaults, Gilbo died in 2011 at the age of 56. These were brutal attacks. The brothers barely survived them. They were hospitalized for a period of time. When they returned to their home, the first thing they did was install a telephone and fix up the damage that these guys did to their home. The two brothers lived at this house for some time longer before moving to a nursing facility. Mike died in 1991, followed by Harry in 1999. Then in 2016, the Dutch Burn house was destroyed in a fire.
On the night Brianna Maitland disappeared and her car wound up backed into the Dutch Burn barn, Jillian Stout wasn't worried about her. When Brianna never showed back up that night, Jillian assumed she had moved back with her parents. Jillian left town for the weekend, and when she returned on March 23rd, she phoned Kelly Maitland to see if Brianna was there. She wasn't, and Kelly hadn't seen her all weekend. Kelly began calling Brianna's friends, but no one had seen her. Bruce Maitland was in New York on business at the time, so Kelly called him and he drove through the night to get back home. Kelly called police to report their daughter missing.
Brianna's friend, who she lived with, happened to have been gone for the weekend. So when Brianna's friend got back home, there was a note there from Brianna and said, I'll see you when I get done work. And so when she got back home, I guess this would have been a Monday at some point. Brianna wasn't there. So she called around, and one of the places she called was us and said, hey, do you know where Brianna is? And we said, no. And we thought she was with you. And she said, no, she hasn't been home all weekend. And then, things just kind of started to go downhill from there.
The next day, Bruce and Kelly drove to the state police barracks in St. Albans. When they gave information to the officers about Brianna's car, one of the officers showed them a picture of the abandoned Oldsmobile partially lodged inside the Dutch Burn house. Bruce and Kelly recognized it immediately as Brianna's car, and they knew something bad had happened to their daughter. Brianna would never have left her car in that condition. Bruce described reporting his daughter missing, as well as the response by police.
You know, quite frankly, when we got the phone call from Brianna's girlfriend, we weren't that concerned right away, because it was like, well, Brianna didn't come home, and we're thinking, well, maybe Brianna went to one of her other friends' houses or something, or came home. Nobody was around anyhow, so she went somewhere else. And so it was something that concerned us. And we called a couple of Brianna's friends, and Brianna's friend says, well, we don't know where she's at. We haven't seen her. But you're still not at that level of panic yet, because you figure, well, Brianna and the car have went somewhere. Because we weren't monitoring her on an hourly or even a daily basis at that point. But when we did get really concerned, like the next day, it was like, well, we went down and reported it. And we happened to be in the police station when we were reporting it. The actual trooper happened to be in the station, kind of in the background. And he called us in and, he pulls out his file because he had taken a file picture and says, well, is this Brianna's car? Well, at that point, shit hits a fan, because in our own mind we know, oh my god, the car's there, where's Brianna? It was just terrifying to know that. Well, and then you get into the questions, well, when did you take this? Well, I took it Saturday. At that point you just start going crazy. And we got called in, and they said, well, I called in and said, well, the lieutenant is the one that's in charge. We talked to him. So we went in and talked to him, and he's like, oh, these kids do this all the time. They take off. They don't tell their parents. She'll be back in a couple, three days. Don't worry so much, but we'll file a missing report. We'll do all that part of it. But, in the meantime, I immediately came back, and my son happened to be around. So we went right to where she worked and started asking questions. Have you seen her? Where you're, because we just started looking for her. And we started to look there, and we, went around where the car was found and started to work out from there and look and see, to see if we could find her. And
later on, the Class Kids Search Center, when it kind of hit the news, they called up and we had a massive search. And we had another one the following weekend, and we've just found nothing.
The Maitlands, along with their son, Waylon, drove to the automotive shop where Brianna's car was towed. Police had not yet inspected the car. Bruce took a crowbar and pried the trunk open. He was scared to death of what he would find inside that trunk, but Brianna was not in there. Inside the car, though, there were some items that Brianna would not have left behind, including her driver's license, her ATM card, contact lenses, migraine medication, and the two paychecks. Brianna did not own a cell phone.
Canine units searched the open field surrounding the Dutchburn house, but found nothing. Brianna's car was taken to the state police barracks, and police conducted a forensic examination of the car. Police found no evidence of foul play and figured Brianna left on her own accord. Friends had said she was thinking about taking a short trip, but the family feared someone had abducted her. Bruce Maitland drove to the Black Lantern Inn to talk to their employees, and for days after Brianna vanished, her family and friends plastered missing person posters around the area. One of the obstacles they encountered was that nobody knew what Brianna was last wearing, so they couldn't put that on the posters. Brianna's new black pants were still in the shopping bag at the Stout residence, so she wasn't wearing them when she went missing. But that makes sense, since she wouldn't have been wearing them, because she apparently bought them for the diner job she was supposed to start the following morning. Brianna wore an apron when she worked at the Black Lantern Inn, but it's not known if she was wearing it when she left that night. Her Aunt Tammy said Brianna always wore a pair of hiking boots, and those boots were missing.
Information started coming into the Maitlands after the posters went up. Someone said they saw a white pickup truck parked down the road from the Black Lantern Inn on March 19th. Another person said that they heard a man shouting later that night, and yet another person said a man had been flirting with Brianna at the inn. Bruce turned all of the information that they received over to the police, but nothing came out of it. Police continued searching for Brianna on land, by air, but she was never found. For whatever reason, they never checked for fingerprints on Brianna's car, and it was months before they requested DNA samples from both Bruce and Kelly. There are no fingerprints on file for Brianna. After she vanished, the assault charges against Keeley LaCrosse were dropped because Brianna didn't show up for the hearing. Bruce Maitland received an anonymous tip that his daughter was being held against her will about 10 miles from the Dutchburn barn in a farmhouse on Reservoir Road in Berkshire.
The Vermont State Police, U.S. Border Patrol, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents raided the rented farmhouse, but didn't find Brianna. However, they did find marijuana, cocaine, drug paraphernalia, and guns. Four people were living in the farmhouse at the time. Ramon L. Ryans of Queens, New York, and his cousin, Nathaniel Charles Jackson of North Carolina. Stephanie A. Machia and Timothy Powell, both of Berkshire, were also living there. Police arrested all four people, and they admitted to knowing Brianna, but all of them denied having anything to do with her disappearance. Ryans, who went by the nickname Street, and Jackson, who went by Low, left the area after their arraignment and bond release. Jackson left the state, and Ryans went to Burlington, Vermont. Ryans and Jackson both flip-flopped their stories on whether they knew Brianna Maitland. One minute they did know her, the next they didn't. However, investigators were able to make the connection, but had no evidence to support their involvement in Brianna's case.
Private investigator Greg Overracker spoke with Lance and Tim of the podcast Crawlspace, and he said this about Ryans and Jackson. He said, these guys knew her name. They knew her well. I can put each of them with Brianna one-on-one, where people walked in and they were together, just the two of them. There's actually an incident where that big old car Brianna had came roaring down the country road And Brianna's brother Waylon sat there and watched her tear past their house. Jackson and Ryan's were in a car behind her, tearing after her. So they know her and they won't admit it. Overracker also said Jackson and Ryan's moved to northern Vermont to traffic crack cocaine. This was a huge problem for the state of Vermont. Dealers from Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York began to make their way into some of the smaller Vermont communities where they were either short on police staff or, in some cases, had no police force at all.
The dealers, including Ryan's and Jackson, targeted and sold drugs to the local kids. In towns where there wasn't much for kids to do, like where Brianna lived, many kids turned to drugs and partying. Brianna is believed to have been part of the drug scene, but her own use of drugs is debatable. Early in the investigation, investigators pretty much said her drug use contributed to her disappearance. However, while not denying Brianna may have dabbled in drugs, her family does not believe it contributed in any way to her disappearance. Brianna's father, Bruce, said that while she may have dabbled with marijuana, she wasn't into hard drugs. They have always believed she was abducted. Overacker also said he received the tip about Raymond Ryan's. He recounted that tip as follows. Someone asked Brianna to get drugs from Ryan's. She gave him the money, went to pick up the drugs, and Ryan's didn't have them. He just said, pretty much flat out, "What are you going to do?" So at that point, she just got ripped off by a drug dealer, and she confronted him, and there was an altercation.
So I think it's pretty clear that Jackson and Ryan's were not saints. But the question is, did they have something to do with Brianna's disappearance? Chloe Cantor wrote on her blog, Chloe from Crawl Space, that some of the teenage girls in Brianna's circle felt uncomfortable around Lowe because he pressured them, he begged them to go to the city, either Burlington or even New York City. And he did this by offering them drugs, money, and the opportunity to stay at some of the finer hotels. Chloe also wrote that she learned from multiple sources that Lowe did convince a local girl to go to New York City with him. This girl was excited to see New York City for the very first time, but as soon as they arrived, Lowe tried to pimp her out. When the teenager refused, he ditched her. Shortly after Brianna Maitland's disappearance, some of her friends were at a McDonald's drive-thru when Charles Jackson allegedly yelled at them that if he was arrested for Brianna's disappearance, then they'd all go down with him and they'd all go missing too.
On July 4th, 2004, 25-year-old LaGia Collins, who went by the nickname Gia, disappeared from her Burlington, Vermont apartment. Ryan's was her live-in boyfriend at the time and was the first person to report her missing. Gia's body was found at the end of July 2004 in a wooded area in Green Mountain National Forest outside Ripton, Vermont. She had been murdered. Cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head, and the murder weapon was likely a baseball bat. One of Ryan's associates, a woman named Ellen Ducharme, confessed to Gia's murder and was later convicted and sentenced to prison in 2006. She told authorities that she hit Gia with a baseball bat while robbing Gia during a prearranged drug deal.
According to reports at that time, Gia had armed herself with a handgun and planned on selling crack cocaine to Ducharme early on July 5th, 2004. But things went awry. A fight broke out over payment, and Ducharme hit Gia with the baseball bat in a fit of crack-induced rage. She then called her boyfriend, Moses Robar, and he and another person dumped Gia's body outside Ripton. Robar shot himself in the head just a short while later on July 12th. Ryan's was never charged in Gia's death, but it's hard to ignore the possibility of Ryan's involvement in really, to me, more both of these cases. He was acquainted with Brianna Maitland. He was obviously very acquainted with Gia. So you have one woman that disappeared, one woman that was murdered. the common denominator is that they both knew Ryan's.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
In 2006, police received a tip about a possible sighting of Brianna at a casino in New Jersey. A Vermont business owner was visiting the casino on the evening of January 17th when he saw a young woman playing at a blackjack table at Caesars Casino in Atlantic City. She bore a striking resemblance to Brianna. The woman was with an older white male in his 40s, and she didn't appear to be in distress. She was chatting with her companion and others at the table. The businessman was convinced that the young woman was Brianna. He didn't go up to her and ask if she was Brianna, but he called police when he returned to Vermont, and they went to the casino and obtained the casino's security footage. Images of the woman were released to the media in 2006, but she has never been identified. Brianna's family was shown the footage. Waylon said it was not Brianna, but her parents were initially on the fence about it. But after the images were blown up, Brianna's parents agreed that the woman wasn't their missing daughter. This was only one of several dead-end leads that came in. Bruce addresses the frustration over so many dead-end leads and what he calls falsehoods.
There's been so much falsehoods thrown out. I mean, we could go on for hours. You know, there was pictures of Brianna taken supposedly on a camera in Atlantic City. I consider that to be a falsehood. Someone that looked like Brianna, for sure, but it wasn't Brianna. I've always been very open to people with ideas about kind of what may happen. And so people take these cases, you know, online or something, and, you know, quite frankly, different ideas have come up and you know, and actually some good information has come up from time to time that people pick up on podcast stories or different things like that. So I try to just absorb it in. You know, obviously people will give me information that I know isn't true, and I'm open to it. So I think really I wouldn't consider it a waste. I mean, obviously we're not going to look at something we know is false, but I certainly wouldn't fault anyone else for looking at it and coming up with different conclusions. Anytime you did a TV show or disappeared or one of those things, you get calls from, or they would get calls from, all over the country. And, quite frankly, all over the world. And they still kind of trickle in. I mean, I 3-4 years ago, there was and you just kind of wonder sometimes, but there was I'll tell you a story that I probably never told, a policeman from Italy, of all places, called in and said, well, hey, there's this girl I've been interacting with. She's obviously American. I think this, this maybe could be Brianna, and, here's her picture. And, when you get that picture, obviously it's not. But, these kind of things still trickle in, I mean, it is amazing. Your emotional response is, oh, my God, she's alive somewhere. I mean, there's always that sliver of hope that kind of gets regenerated.
There has been a lot of talk on whether or not Brianna's case could be related to the disappearance of Maura Murray. Police say that they're not. Maura disappeared 5 weeks before Brianna on February 9th, 2004, under similar circumstances. We covered that case on episode 46. Maura disappeared after getting into a small single car accident on the night of February 9th. She's never been found. Both girls were young brunettes whose vehicles were found damaged and abandoned after they disappeared. There has even been talk of a possible serial killer. FBI investigated whether serial killer Israel Keyes was responsible for Brianna and Maura's disappearances. And this is a case, Morph, that I covered with Gibby on True Crime All the Time. Israel Keyes is a fascinating guy. I don't know if that's the right word, but I think it is in the context of our true crime obsession. He's confessed to the 2011 murders of Bill and Lorraine Currier of Excess, Vermont, and he was linked to the murder of 18-year-old Samantha Koenig of Alaska. He also confessed to as many as 5 unnamed victims, 4 in Washington State and 1 on the East Coast, a body that he claims he dumped in New York. And I think this is a part of what makes Keyes so fascinating. He traveled extensively. He planned extensively. He traveled to the East Coast to visit family in Maine. He also had property in Constable, New York. But FBI agents learned through financial records that he was somewhere else on the days that both Brianna and Maura disappeared. And so they subsequently ruled him out as a suspect in both of their disappearances. And when it comes to the connection between Brianna Maitland and Maura Murray, to date, the police have said that there is no evidence to suggest that the two cases are related.
Brianna Maitland has never been found. Her case has been featured on Dateline's NBC, and Investigation Discovery's Disappeared. It was also profiled on an episode of the Oxygen Network docuseries, The Disappearance of Maura Murray. Since Brianna Maitland vanished, her parents, Bruce and Kelly Maitland, have divorced, but both are still actively searching for the truth about what happened to Brianna. If there's any bright spot in this case, it's that the search for the truth in Brianna's case led Bruce Maitland to become involved in a project that helps other people that have been through similar experiences. That project is called Private Investigations for the Missing.
I use two private investigators that I cover expenses some on them. They've been very, very generous with their time on me. And one, Greg Overacker, has probably been with me for over 10 years. And through all the experiences that I've had with private investigators, and Lou Barry is another one that actually has, done a lot for me. But I've come to realize there's some real value in private investigators, especially when the police have gotten to the point of where the case is more or less a cold case for them. People could qualify, and I've had a couple of private investigators I worked with, which, I didn't think were that good. But these two guys, I learned the lesson that people will give tons of information to private investigators that they will never give to police. And good private investigators are, atrociously expensive and for regular people to be able to afford. When you're talking, $60 to $100 an hour plus expenses, they can just drive a regular middle-class guy like me, right? You could destroy yourself financially. The rest of your life in some aspects has gone to shit. You really don't, want to destroy all of it. So we talked about this and we thought, wouldn't it be great if there was an organization that, would connect with families and actually use investigators to help families with their missing loved ones. And, we both thought it was a great idea and we kind of kicked it around and I really was hesitant about it for a while. But last year I decided to do it. And, we started Private Investigations for the Missing. And, the goal there is exactly as the name says, is we've screened the investigators, and the long-term goal is to have investigators all through the country if we can get the funding, because I've also determined that having a local investigator that knows the culture, knows the area, knows who's who, is the best person to get answers. The goal here is to have a team of investigators that we can choose cases where we can help families to find their missing loved ones and be able to compensate those investigators. And I found I've had a lot of, good feedback from different investigators, and guys have just not going to, we're not looking for the type of investigator that just wants billable hours. We're looking for the type of guy that is willing to do this as not for free. People should be paid for their interview time, but, do the research time and then take it on as sort of a little bit of a giving back mission in themselves. We're fundraising for that now. We're actually looking at some cases that we would like to get on as soon as we get to a funding level that we can, you know, up and go on it. And it's just a tremendous, I know from my own feelings, when nothing's going on, it feels a lot worse than if someone's looking or something has something going on. It just gives you, there's a certain spark of hope that it gives to people like me to know that somebody's looking at their loved one's case and is trying to find answers. Check out our website. I'm not much of an internet guy, but I guess we got a Twitter page and a Facebook page or Twitter account and a Facebook page and private investigations for the missing.org. You know, we'd love to have people help. If they can't help in any other way, please, if they're going to buy stuff on Amazon, put our organization is your organization of choice for Amazon Smile. You know, where Amazon will contribute to 0.5% of anything you buy. One of the things when we were kicking it around to get it started is there's groups for missing people, missing children and stuff, but very few people do actually on the ground real help to families. The biggest one, you know, is the clearinghouse. Your person will get its name in the clearinghouse, and, you know, but as far as providing real help to families, you know, the Class Kids Search Center helped me by putting on a search, and that's something they do right away, as soon as they can when someone goes missing. But after a case gets cold, as far as I know, there's no one else that's actually going to step in there and step up and help families. So I'm determined to make this all work and happen.
Bruce talked about what drives him to keep going in the search for his daughter.
Well, for me, it's never really been a choice. You know, you just kind of, it's a determination that I'm just going to keep on looking for the rest of my life, you know, and if necessary, to try to find her and find out what happened and possibly, you know, see some people come to justice. And I know I've talked with a lot of different parents over the years of missing kids, and a lot of them kind of take different routes in it. A lot of them kind of just retreat and they move into a hole there. And, you know, I've just been determined, and I've spent time in that hole. Okay. But, for sure. But I've determined myself that I'm just going to keep going on. So it's becoming a life mission for me.
When Brianna Maitland was last seen in 2004, she was described as having brown hair, hazel eyes. She was 5'4", weighed between 105 and 118 pounds. If you have any information about the missing persons case of Brianna Maitland, we want you to contact the Vermont State Police at 802-524-5993.
Special thanks goes out to Bruce Maitland for joining us for this episode, and thanks to Debbie Buck at TrueCrimeDiva.com for writing and research assistance. Once again, if you'd like to learn even more about Brianna's case, be sure to check out our friends Chloe, Tim, and Lance over at their podcast, True Crime Twins, Crawl Space, and Missing Maura Murray. We'll have a great conversation about Brianna's case with Lance and Tim going up on our Patreon feed. So if you're a Patreon supporter, be sure to watch your Patreon feed for that.
As always, if you haven't done so yet, take a minute, go out, give us a 5-star rating if you love the show. Keep telling your friends about criminology. It goes a long way.
And if you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter with the handle at Criminology Pod. You can also find us on Facebook. Just search for Criminology Podcast. Or join our Facebook discussion group, which is Criminology Podcast Discussion and Fans.
So tough case, more for sure. As a lot of these disappearance cases are, right? Brianna Maitland, Maura Murray, hundreds, thousands of people who have disappeared and are still missing. I think you can hear that from Brianna's father. It takes an incredible toll on the family. It's something that they live with every single day. You know, as a parent, and all parents out there listening know as well, there's nothing you wouldn't do for your children, and you would never give up searching for them. You'd do anything you had to do. I think it also is heartbreaking when you try to put yourself in that position. And it's almost impossible not to, right, Morph? Thinking about that as you listen to a case, as you research a case. I have a daughter. It's not that hard for me to put myself in the position of Bruce Maitland. And it breaks my heart.
And I think in some of these missing person cases that we cover, I'm always amazed to see some of the similarities there are between the cases and, unfortunately, between the families that are going through the same kind of grief looking for answers in the case. So, you know, my heart goes out to them having to deal with that.
Yeah, can't be easy at all. But that is it for another episode of Criminology. As always, we'll be back with you next Saturday night with an all new episode. So until then, for Mike Ferguson
and Morph,
we'll talk to you next week.
Take care, everyone.